KPRX.
Coming up Friday afternoon at 1 on KRVS.
Regional Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS-FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest in the studio today is singer, songwriter, musician, guitarist Sam Broussard. Many folks in the area know Sam today as a member of Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys. However, Sam has quite a history, lived away from the area for quite a while. I think a lot of people were probably thrilled that he moved back because they get to take part of his talent. Sam, just go with it.
Oh,
welcome.
Oh, fine.
Actually, a person that I have met that you are the first person I've met that, and I am going to bring this up, that got to play on the Johnny Carson show. That is something new that I learned about you this week.
Yeah, that was
a long time ago. But that had to be a cool thing.
It was.
There's not a lot of people who got to do that.
No, there wasn't. And somewhere I've got a photograph of me and the drummer I was working with at the time, and we're standing in Johnny Carson's parking space. You know, I think there's a lot of people now who don't know who Johnny Carson was, but to me he was America, you know.
He was America.
And on late night, and
it was always a big thrill when we got to stay up, when our parents would let us stay up late and catch part of the show.
And even after I'd left home, and whenever I'd come back to visit my parents, I would still stay up late at night with them. You know, I would go in their bedroom and we'd watch Johnny Carson. I always called it the Carson Show. I never called it the Tonight Show.
Yeah,
because it was Johnny Carson. And yeah, I got to do it when Doc Severinsen. Eric Severide was a journalist. Doc Severinsen was a trumpet player. They weren't related. Doc Severinsen was running the band, and the interesting thing to me, and I hope would be interesting to anybody else, was that how low tech the entire set of The Tonight Show was. I mean, right now it's probably all digital, this and laser that.
Oh, yeah.
Back then, I mean, after we did...
How old were you when you got to, like, in your 20s?
I think so. I did it twice.
Ah.
I don't have a memory of one of those times. So what does that tell you?
Yeah.
Yeah, been there, done that. Trying to remember the second time.
Yeah.
The first time, it's just how funky the whole set was. It was a cavernous area, and the green room was really green. And the part that I like to tell people about playing the Johnny Carson show was, you know, that Doc and Johnny would always make a lot of jokes about how much. I'm sorry, not Doc.
Ed McMahon.
Ed McMahon. They would make jokes about how much Ed liked to drink. Because you could do that then.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a part of life, and therefore it was okay to talk about it. And so we figured, the drummer and I, it's always the drummer, you know.
Yeah.
We figured, the drummer and I, that there's a place somewhere to get a drink. Now, we hadn't performed
yet. Oh, so they didn't have drinks in the green room?
No.
Okay.
No, I think they had some fake plastic fruit and a couch. So we went looking for the bar, and we looked all over. We went in this behind the stage, you know. We walked along the side of the audience. I remember the actress Terry Garr was another one of the guests, and we listened to her talk.
Oh yeah, she was young.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I remember she was very funny and she had freckles.
Yeah,
she was very good. And so we're looking for it, and we passed by. There's a monitor backstage where you can see what's going on. You can see the same thing that everybody else in America is looking at. And that monitor was an old Motorola television set that would have taken four people to lift. It was a piece of low-tech from hell. It was cheap. It was outdated. It was in black and white, and that's how you viewed what was going on in there. Everything was really, really funky.
Yeah.
And including the rehearsal. But anyway, the drummer and I were looking for the bar.
Now, was this with Michael Martin Murphy?
Yes.
Is that who you were playing
with?
Michael
Martin Murphy, whoever remembers him. And we had to ask somebody where the bar was, and it was the first time I'd ever heard this word. Oh, it's in the credenza.
I
didn't know what a credenza was. I thought it was, classical music, technological term or something. So it was this big round thing. And the drummer and I went over there, and we saw a bucket of ice, and we opened the cabinet, and there was some very cheap Popov vodka, and there was some orange juice. So we set about, the two youths not knowing, we set about making ourselves some screwdrivers.
That's like the...
Yeah.
That's like the cheap bar.
They call it a wet bar. Yeah. I don't know why they call it a wet bar. I don't know. It's hard to stay dry in its vicinity.
Yeah.
So we made ourselves some drinks, and we heard behind us, "What are you two guys doing?" And we turned around and we looked, and there's an old guy standing behind us, and he's got a very long-barreled pistol in his hand.
Wow, Lord.
And we looked at him. He said, "Excuse us?" He said, "What are you boys doing?" We said, we're making drinks. We assumed it would be okay. I mean, this is... the way it comes across on television,
you know.
Assume we could make some drinks. And he said, "Okay, don't you get drunk." He said, no, sir, absolutely. And he waved that gun and he walked away. And I said, "Hey, excuse me, who are you?" He said, "I'm the prop man." He walked away. And we had our drinks and we went on and did the show. My other memory of it was at rehearsal. What you had to do, so we were going to be backing up the star of the moment, the guy I happened to be working with at that time, working for. And he was going to be front and center in the camera, and the rest of us in his band would be off camera. So what you had to do was you had to stand in the Doc Severinsen orchestra pit. I stood right next to the guitar player while he played during a commercial break, and I'm watching him sight read this stuff that another 50 years I wouldn't be able to sight read something like that.
Yeah.
He's just sight reading this stuff, and then he gets up, he unplugs his guitar, and he hands me the cable end, and I sit down and plug in. And so at rehearsal I said, "I need to sing background harmonies." And they said, "Okay, we'll give you a microphone." So they, on a very long boom stand, they swung over the horn section mic. And it's coming towards me, and I reach out and I grab it, and I got my hand on the guitar and I touched the microphone, and it shocked the hell out of me. And I said, "Whoa, this thing shocked me." And Doc Severinsen said, "That's just our way of saying hello."
Oh, Lord.
You know, and everything was very, very, very low tech about this thing.
And
even back then in the, when was this? It's either the late 70s or early 80s. You just expected more high-tech in a situation like that. But it was very funky. Nobody bothered to spend any money on making it any better than it was on the technical standpoint, because it had cameras. It had Johnny Carson.
Yeah, that's all you needed.
And great guests. And nothing needed to be improved, so nobody bothered.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Have you played on any of the shows that are on late-night TV now? Have you been on any of those?
Yeah, I was in a Nashville band, and we played the Conan O'Brien show.
You probably noticed a difference. Did you notice a difference in the tech stuff, the tech equipment on that?
Yeah. That was definitely in keeping with modern times, although that happened so fast, I don't have much of a memory of it.
Who were you playing with then?
I was playing with Nashville One or Two Hit Wonders, Flash in the Pan group, called a duo called Foster and Lloyd.
Oh, okay.
And Radney Foster went on to become a solo artist.
Yeah.
And Bill Lloyd went on to become a notable songwriter and producer. And they were two really, really smart guys. And
yeah.
They had a good thing going. They were combining rockabilly. They were doing rockabilly and combining modern rock and roll sensibilities with country music at an early time of people doing that. I can't remember some of the people who used to play them, but they had a lot of hip people playing on their records. They made good records. And I was really happy to have that job for the short time that it lasted.
Well, how old were you when you left here? Because you grew up in Lafayette, right?
I left here when I was either 18 or 19.
And was it to pursue music?
It was to get away from the heat and the humidity. But yeah, I did get a phone call from a guy in Baton Rouge, a guy from around Baton Rouge. He called me up and he said, me and some other Louisiana guys are going up to Colorado because we can work up there in a band. Somebody told me you play guitar real good. You want to go? You know. I said, yeah, this would be a really, really good time to get the hell out of here. I was not doing well with the heat. You know, my of looking at it was, you know, I was 19 years old. You know, I wanted to date girls, and it was just embarrassing asking a girl out for a date when you had these big patches of sweat under your armpits, and I didn't have enough personal cool to know how to deal with that. You know,
See, it always comes back to, like, with musicians a lot of time, it's always about the girls. You know, you
move.
Well,
yes, Cheryl, it is, frankly. girls and free beer, you know.
Yeah.
And, well, you figure if you can't get the girls with your own personal cool, you pick up a guitar and hope that you can borrow some of its cool.
That's right.
And wear it for your very own.
Now, what kind of music were you playing?
We were doing contemporary folk music. We were doing a pretty wide range of stuff, but, you know, we would do old blues stuff. We would do older and current folk music, not so much really popular folk music. Like at that time, Hootenanny and, what was the Kingston Trio, you know, was real big. America was singing along to, you know, twanging banjos.
Yeah.
And
I mean, because, you know, Sam, I don't really know much about, like, your history as really young. Did you, is that the style of music that you were interested in yourself, or, you know, what?
Yeah, I was, partially that, yeah. I was interested in anything that music emanated from at that time.
Okay.
I didn't have any personal preferences. I just liked things that I thought were good, and I actually thought I knew what was good and what wasn't.
Yeah.
It took a decade or so to disabuse myself of that notion that I actually knew anything. but at that time, I thought, well, I loved harmony singing. I grew up listening to my parents' records, and I loved harmony.
Who were they listening to?
They listened to the Platters and the Four Lads, and my father had played in big bands.
Ah.
And so they listened to big band music.
What instrument?
A lot of, he played sax.
Ah.
And there was a lot of the popular music of the 50s. And some of the 40s in the house, you know, organ duos, saxophones. A lot of it would be considered really corny by today's standards, and a lot of it was timeless.
Yeah.
And I'm going through that music now, and I'm finding a lot of gold in there.
That's great.
I just dug up standing on the corner watching all the girls go by
the
other day. Brother, you can't go to jail for what you're thinking. Offer the woo look in your eye.
Yeah.
What's a woo look in your eye? I don't really know what it is, but all I know is you can't go to jail for it.
That's right.
You know, I really love that music, whether it's corny or not.
Oh, I mean, I grew up with all that, too. You know, the one thing that you were just doing right now, and that is something that comes off of you, you know, really easy to tell, is is your writing. You're a really good writer, and your use of words. When you started out your early days as a musician, was the writing or the vocals, was that a part of your playing, or was it focused on just guitar at that time?
Well, it was all of it. I'm not sure that young people were any typically more focused than that at that time. So that you can sing and put your voices together. And God, we used to love to sing and create those harmonies. That was a lot of fun. But I got interested in every aspect of writing songs. And then, true to form of the rebellious young man that I was, I got interested in the part that people cared the least about, which was the words. I just really happened to like the words of songs, most of which are crap. And they're supposed to be, actually. They're not supposed to.
Because why?
They're not supposed to derail your thinking. You know, you're not supposed to pay too much attention to it. You know, it's supposed to be a soundtrack for your life. It's not supposed to be like a book, which is something that can actually change your life. But then, you know, I remember at that time, you know, I saw Dave Van Ronk, you know, and he sang a couple of songs that were life-changing as far as I was concerned, and Bob Dylan was changing people's lives. And there were, you know, Paul Simon, there were people writing songs that could actually change your life just like a book could do.
Yeah.
And I started seeking those songs out, and I've been seeking them out ever since, because I'm basically lazy, and if something's going to change my life, I want it changed in 3 minutes or less. You know, it takes a long time to read a book. And I'll read those too, but, you know, a 3-minute song that can just make you see the whole world differently, to me, is a magical thing.
And magical if you can condense it down to that, the message down to that, and be able to get that crossed in it, you know?
Yes, that's what songs are.
That's where the art comes in.
That's what songs.
And the talent.
Writing is a summing up.
Yeah.
Your writing is what you wish you had said on that telephone call that didn't go so well. You hang up the phone and you go, nah. Stupid. You should have said, okay, well, all those things you should have said, you can say when you sit down to write, and you're writing it your way, and no one's paying attention to you, but you are. You're paying attention to yourself, and you're your own best, well, that's my best critic right there, and there's my biggest fan right there. He's paying attention to me, standing beside yourself, paying attention to yourself, and I just really love that whole process. I really, really love it. I don't really care if anybody listens to what comes out of it or not. I just really like that.
What you do for you.
Yeah.
Can we listen to something? Now, I know you brought in Veins. You brought in that one.
They're both here. Well, there's one song from the earlier one here. Where do you want to start?
I want to do something that you wrote.
We can start with number two. Which is a song called Sleeping, Your Sleeping Face. It's from an album I made, I think, in the year 2000. It was an innocent time. It was the best of times and the worst of times. This is a song about a person living in an oppressive society, or he's not living in a oppressive society, yet he has dreams that he is. And he wakes up in the middle of the night because he has a bad dream. And then he looks at his beloved, and he can't go back to sleep because her face is so beautiful to him. And in my song, I have these things perfectly fleshed out like movies. In my song, she's not terribly beautiful, but she is to him.
Very good. Let's listen to Sam Broussard's Sleeping Face.
Sleep again. face was a peaceful prayer. My whisper was amen, amen. And I had a dream of freedom. Bells rang in the streets. By sundown we were drunk. We danced on cool concrete. And I sang both myself. What the hell was that song? Then I saw your sleeping face, staying awake till dawn, till dawn. No matter the beauty of these dreams of grace, may I never wake from your sleeping face, sleeping face.
Sleeping Face, Sam Broussard off his first CD, Geek. If you're just joining us, my guest today in the studio is Sam Broussard. Beautiful playing on that song, whether you think so or not, Sam.
I love the playing.
Oh, good.
I do.
And the lyrics?
I love the lyrics. You can take the singer out and bring him to the vet and have him put to sleep, but...
but you like...
I love the song.
Yeah, no, that was when you said you had recorded in your house.
Yeah.
And all the equipment you had there.
Yeah.
When you went to record that CD, was it difficult? I'm curious how much or how many songs you had to choose from at that time. I would assume you had a lot, but I don't know how much you were putting down into songs at that time.
That was 1997. That was a very fruitful year. I got very angry at other people who were making a living playing bad songs.
Huh?
And I thought, I want to make a living playing bad songs. And so I'd started to write. I'd gone to the Kerrville Folk Festival.
When did you move back here?
94, 95.
Okay, all right.
And I'd gone to the Kerrville Folk Festival, and I was walking around, and I was listening to people who were getting hired to play, just to stand up there and and play songs that they had written, and I thought most of it was horrible. So I went home and always knew I could write, and so I did, and I was younger then. I had an awful lot of energy, and I would just wake up in the middle of the night wanting to write something down, and I thought that, you know, 10% of the ideas coming out of my head were good, which is unusual. That's an unusually high percentage, you know, because the thing about writing, or successful writing anyway, is it's not writing. It's being able to choose what's worth keeping and what's not. That's what I think talent is being able to recognize the right decision to make out of a giant pile of garbage. Because I don't meditate, but I've heard people talk about meditation. You know, you sit there and then all these worthless thoughts just drift by. It's like, you know, watching this TV screen inside your mind of all these things. You know, you see an empty stewed tomato can drifting by in front of you, and a list of errands and things that you have to do, and a pair of shoelaces that you found in the street when you were 3 years old. There's just all this garbage that floats by, and talent, I think, is reaching in and picking out which one of those things you can use for the purpose that you have set for you. It's not like great stuff comes out of your head. Great stuff certainly doesn't come out of my head, but I just try and put it in a big pile and pull things out, you know, like a lot of the images in that song are just some of those images that just floated by and they weren't worth anything by themselves.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, do you see a purpose in the songs that are written that the lyrics don't really make you think about much, and the lyrics are just kind of, but it's a catchy tune?
I don't know. I just do what I think is good. That's all. I just do what I think is good, not what somebody else thinks is good. That way lies spiritual death. So you just go to what you like.
Now, you write with other people.
I have.
Is that a difficult process for you?
It can be.
I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, because you have this pretty, it seems like you have this pretty kind of strict guidelines that,
yeah, I want it to be good.
but I mean, you know, for what you want, and I get that, you know, you want it to be good, but what somebody else may think is good may be different from what you think is good.
Sure, that happens, you know? It's a relationship, and what could go wrong in a relationship? What could possibly go wrong there? It's a relationship like any other, and everybody else has their idea of what's good and what's not,
And has there ever been a song maybe that you worked on with somebody where your mind was changed? You know, where it's like, okay.
No, never.
Maybe, okay.
Absolutely never. No, my mind was never changed. Because I have in the back of my mind, it can always be better. I don't care how good it is right now or how good we think it is. It can always be better.
So how do you stop? When you're writing a song, how do you stop? If that's the thought, it can always be better.
Exhaustion. You just get really tired of it, you know. I try to tell people who... I have talked to people about writing songs before, and it's just amazing how easily people are satisfied with their own ideas sometimes. You know, they think, oh, this fell out of my head, therefore it's good. No. No. Yes, you are being creative. It's not the same as being good. You need to back up a little bit. And I use this thing called modeling where, you know, I'll take a Bob Dylan lyric that I like or some lyric that I like, and I'll just print it out, and I'll print out my lyrics and I'll put both of them in front of me, and I'll go back and forth from one to the other, and I go, can these two pieces of paper actually sit next to each other on the same desk yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And until those two pieces of paper can live peacefully on the same desk, I'll keep working on it. And I'll work on a preposition for a month if that's how long it takes. I didn't know we were going to talk about this. I wasn't prepared to talk about songwriting. I'm probably saying some goofy stuff.
But, not at all.
You know,
no,
I'll sit there in the car. I'll drive from here to Baton Rouge thinking about just one line. And how to make it better. Because it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more. What else am I going to think about?
And, yeah. You know, but it's been interesting talking to other songwriters, though, who, you know, see what changes, you know, things that they thought were really good at a certain age that they wrote. And then, you know, as you get more life experience, things don't seem to make quite the same sense.
No, they don't. And it's very
ironic. But
that
doesn't mean it was a bad song.
Well, the greatest songs have been written by very young people who haven't lived a whole hell of a lot. And then there are the people who worked on Broadway, you know, who wrote, you know, Oscar Hammerstein, who wrote some incredible stuff as a mature man and got in trouble for some of it and was very much on the cutting edge of the American society and societal mores as they were to become. But they weren't that way when he was writing about it. You know, he was writing about equality. You know, in The King and I, he did some very... He took some chances with things like that. I tend to gravitate that as much as I will gravitate to the songs that came out of a 23-year-old John Lennon or Paul McCartney.
Okay.
You know, or John Lee Hooker. Or any, you know, I'll gravitate towards people that have great insight or just great emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
John Lennon, his emotional intelligence. He was a genius emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he didn't get so far in school, maybe he didn't know a whole lot about books, although I think he did. But that's not important. You know, how was he able to process the pain of having lost his mother? Once when she ran off and married somebody else and you didn't see her, and then later on in life when she died. He lost her twice. How did he process that? Well, these incredible songs came out, and they're gut-wrenching. And they tear me up when I listen to them. And I want to be torn up by music. You know,
okay.
Music's not background to me. It's not wallpaper.
Yeah.
It's not something you listen to and make flippant judgments about unless the music itself desires to be flippant and just to be background and wallpaper, and so much of it is.
Which then takes me to, you brought in some pieces. You're working with a gentleman right now, Jean Arsenault.
Oh, yeah, Jean Arsenault. He's a great Cajun-French poet.
And we've heard things from him before in this area. But now what you're doing with him, from what I understand, is he has poetry that he's written, and you're putting music to that.
Yeah, which is, that's fun. That's really fun. It involves...
How does that process change for you, you know, that whole emotion? Because what you were just talking about is really the strong emotional connection, you know, that happens between, it sounds like, you when you are writing the lyrics and the music to go together, what you were just talking about with John Lennon. There was a real emotion. Does that come in when it's somebody else's words that you're writing music for?
Well, I wouldn't be doing this if that wasn't already there.
Okay.
In the words. And Jean... has a tendency to write about his nightmares, and he does it in Cajun French. And it's not all nightmares, of course.
Yeah.
You know, he writes some really funny stuff. He knows Cajuns, he knows us really well, and he is, no matter what he would have become in life, whether he'd have gone on to selling cars or working at a radio station or for the government or whatever, he would have always written like he's writing now. That's just his sensibility. And so he can write some really gut-wrenching stuff, and it's in French. It's in Cajun French. And that's just, I'm accustomed to working in Cajun French language, and I have the privilege of writing with somebody who writes the best Cajun French words I've ever come across.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Can we listen to one of those tracks?
Yeah. This would be the song called Personne pour me reçoit.
It's track 3, Cecil.
Yeah, track 3.
What's this one about?
This is a song about a guy who goes out and he raises hell. He goes out at night and he does what a lot of other misbehaving people go out and do at night. And up until now, every time he went home, there was somebody there waiting for him. But not tonight.
All right.
There's not going to be anybody waiting for him when he comes home tonight because she's had enough.
Well, this is a collaboration with Jean Arsenault, Sam Broussard.
Yeah.
That's a, boy, what a great song. I may have you say it though, Sam. Personne pour me recevoir.
There was just nobody there.
That's a beautiful. If you're
waiting
just,
for me.
If you're joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. Check out the website too, krvs.org. You can listen to shows that maybe you've missed. Check out what's going on in the news. And it's also a secure site. Please help support the station. This is a public-supported radio station. My guest today in the studio is Sam Broussard. So that lyrics, actually it was a poem first.
Yeah.
It's still a poem written by Jean Arsenault. And then you put the music to it. Who all played on that?
Just me.
That was you? Wow, yeah. Everything.
Well, computers.
Did you computer stuff for that?
Yeah, they're really magical.
Where did you get the sound of the gentleman walking? Was that a recorded thing, or did you do that?
It comes with all the computer stuff.
It did? You know? Okay.
I mean, I had to make it, I had to put it in time, I had to edit and chop it up.
Yeah.
So I printed it out on a piece of paper and got some scissors out, and I cut it up. No, I'm just kidding. I did all that on a screen.
Except for the siren.
The siren at the end, really, that really happened. I still had the microphone on, and I hear a lot of sirens where I live, which is close to Four Corners. Native Lafayette people out there, you know it. You know of what I speak.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of siren noise over there, but that's where I grew up, so I don't really notice it. I don't hear it. You know, I hear the trains over there, too, and I don't...
But that was a great piece at the end.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the gentleman just going home to no one, to nothing, you know?
Yeah, I thought that was in keeping with the lyric, you know, because he's going home. He's too drunk to drive.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not in the lyric, but, you know, that's the way I see it. He's walking home. You know?
Now, I'm curious, when you write music for somebody else's lyrics, do you sit down and have a conversation with them about what they were thinking or feeling as they were writing, or you pretty much have gathered that once
well,
you've read it?
In this situation here, the words were already done. Any getting together was to be able to hammer something into the shape or into the particular melody that I had, but that one was like falling off a log. You know, Jean just handed it to me, I looked at it, and I had to ask him what a couple of words meant. Other than that, I understood the French, and I was just knocked out by the story. And there it was, and it happened really easy. I hate to say that. I'd like to tell you it was a lot of work and
yeah,
how I suffered
yeah.
over it, and you know, but I didn't. It was just really easy.
Now, has that been, besides you having this recording, is that on a CD at all, or are the
no,
two of you
we're,
working
I,
on it?
No, Jean and I are working on a CD. It's almost completed, but I keep having doubts as to whether I'm doing justice to the words or whether I'm going just a little bit too far.
Is it all in French?
Oh, yeah.
Do you write in French when you write songs?
I've done very little, but yeah, I can. It needs to be corrected.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll call up somebody like Jean and say, and beg him to help me.
Yeah, yeah.
He does so because he doesn't want a wretched Cajun French going out over the airwaves. So, you know, he wants to be correct.
As a story or lyrics, sentences are coming to you, do they come in French, or is that something where you translate from English?
I don't know.
When you write?
At this point, sometimes it just if it'll seem like a good idea, like this should be in French, or
okay.
you know, this will just. And you know, I've been studying French for decades. You know, I'm not very good at it, but enough to have. I have enough familiarity with it so that sometimes an idea will tell me itself that it belongs in this other language because of who the people are.
Yeah.
In it, you know, they might be Africans, they might be Cajuns.
Yeah.
So, it depends on what the idea is.
So we can't really pin you down in terms of, do you think this is something that'll be out in the next year?
hard to say, you know. I don't really know. I mean, we could play, I have another song from that project that's really different from that one.
Oh, okay.
It would be number one, Cecil. And this is a song, it's a short poem by Jean about a Creole gentleman named Ben Guinet. And the name of the poem is called Promised Land. And Ben is just talking about what he's done in his life that he's proud of and what he's avoided doing in his life. And he's very proud of that. And he's very proud of what he was able to gather to him in his life. And this is a very short little song.
I fais boire du thé avec Ben, vieux Ben. C'est chaud dans la tasse et c'est froid dans le verre. Attendez qu'on au bout qui est la paix. On dit yo dans l'été. L'été est dans trois choses, mon père, mon cœur, pour jamais, mon dit, pour jamais, voler, pour gagner les
promised land. Maisons from promised land. C'est pas pour monsieur, pas pour monsieur. Non, c'est pour Ben.
That's a very cool song. That's Promised Land, lyrics, Jean Arsenault, and music, Sam Broussard, who is our guest today in the studio. That really was a very, very cool song, Sam.
Yeah, and it's a great story.
And you guys need to, you need to get that out. You need to get that CD done. Keep working on that.
Okay.
But now that was, I want to go back to the other song that we played, though, off of that. And you talked about, because your vocals is the one thing that stood out. And you sang, how did you get the sound, the quality?
Oh, I used my dad was a ham radio operator, and I used his ham radio microphone.
Yeah, that was it was a great sound.
Yeah, it looks like what does those things look like? They look like the 50s version of the future is what they look like.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like a little bullet that you can hold in your hand with sweat. It's an Art Deco looking thing.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And I know we're running short on time. I do want to talk about another project that you're working on, and that's with a group that you're calling Golden Triangle. And that's you and David Greeley.
Right.
And
yeah.
The third person.
I'm thinking maybe we should go out on that.
You want to go out on that one?
On that song.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's a good one to go out on.
Well, then let's listen. Then we're gonna switch around. We can do that easy. Let's listen. We're gonna listen to a song off of.
This is
second CD.
Yeah. I make a CD every 10 years, whether I need to or not. This CD is called
Don't
Veins.
Don't let this one with the poetry go for 10 more years.
Oh, right.
You guys need to finish that one sooner.
Yeah.
Okay, keep
going.
Yeah,
we know. There's been, I've had mental problems finishing this. Those kind of problems. This is a song. It's just about gratitude, and it's in English, so you might be able to tell that it's about gratitude. This is called Devil's Got You by the Tail, and it's from my CD, Veins, which has a really nice cover. You see it? Can you see it out there?
It is a beautiful cover. Who did the work on that one?
That is Eleanor Carucci, a New York photographer who very graciously cut me a really good deal. I mean, she does portraits for the New Yorker magazine and that sort of thing. She cut me a really good deal because she's a really, really sweet person, and I urge you to go on the net and look for Eleanor Carucci. She is a genius photographer.
All right, so this is Sam Broussard.
the front of a bank, up in the sky in vapor trails, or on the plaque below the Holy Grail. But you learn to be grateful that you can ride at all. Until you learn to be grateful, the devil's got you by the tail.
Sam Broussard off of his last released CD, Vain.
Yes.
Are you still with us, Sam?
Yes.
And you had, you said you had Doug Below playing on that one.
Yeah, Doug Below is playing drums on that.
That's a drummer.
Doing an incredible job, yeah. And that was mixed and mastered by local boy Tony Daigle. Mm-hmm. Actually, Tony's from Pierre Park. But,
that's right. Could have been on the show Swamp People, but left town. And
that's right. A lot of those folks are, Tony's not anything like those people.
He talks about growing up, but he knows all of them, though, you know?
He is of those people.
That's right. While we have some time left, I do want to talk about, though, what I brought up a little earlier. Another project that you have going on with a band called Golden Triangle.
Oh, yeah. That's a really fun thing that we fell into. David Greeley and I were thrown into playing with a Texas blues musician by the name of Johnny Nicholas.
How'd you meet him?
He was at the Rhythm and Roots Festival. Narragansett, Rhode Island, and we got thrown together somehow. I don't remember the circumstances because I pretty much don't remember anything. But anyway, we did a workshop together. We ended up on a stage and we started playing together, and we looked at each other and thought, well, this actually sounds good and isn't
and
a whole lot
play?
Of work.
What does he?
Oh, he plays harmonica. He plays guitar. He's a great piano player. Singer, writer, he's really good lyricist. Yeah, he's a good guy. He's really good at what he does. So we thought we'd get together. This is so good it must be documented.
Yeah.
So we went over to Lalu Recording Studio and recorded an album live. And we have a track here.
Did you do any originals on this or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have two original songs. Johnny has several. Johnny does most of the front work in this band.
Is it available for people?
No, it's going to be out soon. It's going to be out at the beginning of next month.
Oh, okay.
We'll have it out. We're going to do some shows in Texas, and we'll have it available those shows. And
will you bring him over here for any shows?
Yeah, we've already played at Blue Moon, but nobody knew who the hell we were. So it's a pretty small crowd, but very friendly crowd.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, we're going to keep plugging away at this thing because we have too much fun doing it. We just can't stop. And the name implies that part of Texas, you know, that centered around a little bit to the left of Beaumont, you know, where a lot of Cajuns went to work in the shipyards during World War II.
That's right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today, Sam.
Thank you, Cheryl. My pleasure.
And we're going to go out listening to the song Jumpin' Judy.
From Golden Triangle.
From Golden Triangle. Everybody have a good week.
Yeah.
She was a mighty fine gal. Oh, well, she brought that jumpin'. Oh, well, she brought that.